Anyone like to convene the April 11th, 2017 meeting of the Subcommittee on Natural Resources for the Joint Committee on Ways and Means? Today we're going to continue our public hearing for the Water Resources Department, and I'm going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 5542. And let's see here. Matt, have we had any background on this bill we had yesterday?
Nope.
No.
Brand new. Yeah.
Brand new. Can you enlighten us, please?
Co-Chair Witt, members of the subcommittee, all of the materials for this next 3 days of hearings are posted on OLIS for you. I'm going to kind of go over some of the highlights of the LFO review. First of all, for those of you who aren't terribly familiar with water resources, it's the administrative arm of the Water Resources Commission. That's a 7-member commission that's appointed by the governor. It's confirmed by the Senate. Water resources primary functions include the enforcement of the state's water laws, and that's the water quantity laws, not the water quality laws, like DEQ. So they record and enforce water rights, the development of water resources, the inspections of wells and dams, and they provide scientific and technical analysis of both surface and groundwater resources. The current service level budget for the agency is about $27.8 million, all funds reduction from the 2015 through 17, or the current biennium budget. This is a little misleading, though, because that's inclusive of a $34 million reduction in other funds limitation from bond proceeds in the current biennium. Lottery funds in this at the current service level increased by $3.5 million for debt service on those bonds. And that's on top of a $1.9 million increase in debt service from the 13-15 biennium. 13-15 biennium. So in the 2015-17 legislatively approved budget for water resources, it's dominated pretty much by other funds that represent proceeds from lottery bond sales that were dedicated to various water projects. The majority of this funding, about $51 million, is from bonds authorized in the 15-17 biennium, with an additional $9.2 million carried forward from 13-15 into the 15-17 biennium. There's a total of $60.2 million in available funding from lottery bonds in 15-17. About $30 million of that was $6.2 million of available funding from lottery bonds. $30 million of that was for the Water Development Loan Program. That's a constitutional bond program where the borrower actually is responsible for repaying the debt. And that facility was not used or has not been used to date at Water Resources, and that's coming out of the 17-19 biennium. So of the remaining $30.2 million, funding was dedicated to various purposes. Some of that funding, about $4.2 million, has been or is anticipated to be spent in the current biennium, but another $26 million is being carried forward at current service level into the 17-19 biennium. And so in the LFO review documents, I've included a table that shows the purpose of those bonds, when they were originally authorized, what the original amount was, and the remaining unspent funds for 17-19. There's also some other funds, debt service in the current service level budget related to the debt service on water development loan bonds had they been issued. And since they haven't been issued, we'll get those backed out before we get into the budget proper. The governor's budget for bonding actually requests another $32 million. $2 million of that would be used for feasibility grants, along with about a $1.5 million of unspent funding that's carried forward from the current biennium, and added to $800,000 in general fund that's in the agency's base budget for the same purpose. The remaining $30 million would be used for to add additional funding to the water supply development account, and that was for purposes under Senate Bill 839 from 2013. And that's added to about $6.25 million that's carried forward into this biennium from the prior biennium. Other issues that the agency is dealing with is there's a sunset of fee increases established in the 13-15 biennium. These are those fees are for a variety of transactions, mostly dealing with the processing of water right applications and transfers and issuing water right certificates or limited licenses. So the sunset in statute rolls the fees that are currently there back to 2009, which will produce about a $375,000 reduction in other funds revenue as a result. There is a piece of legislation, House Bill 2295, that eliminates the sunset and actually presents a fee increase of 15.88%. That bill has been heard in policy committee and is in Ways and Means right now, and will probably become before this committee when we actually do the work session on the agency's budget.
I have a question.
Yes, Senator Girard.
I'm looking at the summary of the budget and other funds limited. Can you go over again how that went from $31,605,000 to $20,690,000 and stayed at around the $20 million mark? Because that's supposed to be fee-driven, and it's hard for me to believe that fees went down somewhere. So,
Senator Girard, I don't think I'm looking at the same document you're looking at.
No, I'm not seeing
it. I wasn't
either.
Following it either, so.
Okay, so the document you're looking at looks like the budget report for the agency's bill from last biennium.
Well, yeah, okay.
So maybe,
but there's still the same question because it maxed out at $31 million in 2013-15, and then it took a dramatic drop. And don't ask me, I'm on the governor's recommended budget, if there was.
Co-Chair Witt, Senator Girard, if you would indulge me, I'd be glad to take a look at that and get you an answer back on it maybe tomorrow. But without it in front of me and being able to look at it, I'd have a hard time giving you it.
Yeah. I like the direction that they were going. I'm just trying.
Okay.
Representative Esquivel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So the way I'm interpreting this is that we've had more money maybe in 2015-17, and then we dropped off some money, and now we're back up to a current service level is less than what it was in 2015-2017 budget. But now if you compared apples and apples and oranges, you would take the amount that's dropped off from the original budget in 2015, and there you'd have your difference. Now, how does that pan out? In other words, do they have more money than they did excluding the lottery situation, or do they have less if you deducted that out?
Chair Wade,
that's a up and down fluid.
Let me use some broad strokes and see if we can get to an answer for you. On the legislative budget review, legislative fiscal office budget review document, you have a 2013-15 actuals column, and you have other funds at $7.7 million. And then you have 2015-17 legislatively approved column where it shows other funds at $74 million.
Right.
That's that large jump between those two, that's roughly $65 million jump. The majority of that is included in bond proceeds. Now, part of it was lottery bond proceeds, and the other piece of it was this authorizations for expenditures of another $30 million in constitutional bond proceeds, but those bonds were never issued and don't appear to be issued.
Okay.
In any case, all of the bond proceeds, all the expenditure authority that was included in the budget for those bond proceeds is removed when you're formulating the 2017 through 19 current service level. That's why you see that huge jump between 13-15 and 15-17.
That's a $33 million drop-off.
Right. Gotcha. Is that answer your question, sort of, or we can get more detail for you, Senator Girard?
It's
okay. No problem.
No, I'm good.
So Matt, the $30 million in unallocated bonding authority is carried over.
Yeah, I'm sorry, Senator, Representative Witt, the co-chair, with the $26 million is being carried forward from 15-17.
And then we're asking for another 32?
That's correct.
Okay.
That's exactly right.
All right. Thank you.
About $5 million difference. You want to look at it like that. There's $5 million difference.
Anyone else? All right.
And, Co-Chair, would just a... I can get you an exact answer, but I believe most of that difference is going to be dealing with, there's $2.5 million that's the other funds expenditure limitation for dealing with debt service for the $30 million of bonds that were not used that needs to be backed out. So that's at least half of it. And the other half of it is just probably standard inflationary costs or increases in expenditures from fee-driven issues.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
So, co-chairs, members of the subcommittee, just to get back to where we were, we were talking about the sunset of these fees. As I said, the agency's got a bill that's passed the policy committee. It's down here at Ways and Means. We will be working that bill with the agency's budget. In addition, there's another fee bill, which is House Bill 2296, which is also at Ways and Means now, and that has to do with establishing and increasing fees around well construction and well inspection, and also provides for bond requirements for well construction. Other issues that the agency is dealing with, beginning not in fiscal year 18, but the following fiscal year 19, Oregon Fish and Wildlife will be required to bill other natural resource agencies for the work that ODFW does on behalf. So we anticipate some kind of budgetary impact to water resources due to that requirement. But we probably won't see that until the 1921 budget. And also in December of this last year, the Secretary of State issued an audit report on the operations of the Water Resources Division. And it had several recommendations, including establishing a better balance between water rights issuance and actions to restore and protect stream flows and watersheds for long-term sustainability, an increased focus on groundwater protection, particularly in well construction and inspection, completion of data collection across the state and meaningful analysis of the data for water management decisions, addressing staffing levels, capacity, and duties to ensure fulfillment of critical responsibilities, and to create a long-term agency plan to focus and prioritize efforts and align efforts with available resources to better meet the agency's mission. And with that, that's all I have for you. So I know that Tom Beiler is here to give you this agency presentation.
All right. Before we shift gears, final opportunity, if there's any questions. Not seeing any. I'd like to ask Director Beiler to please come up. And Tom, if there's anyone else that you'd like to have join you, please have them come up as well. Good afternoon. Welcome to our subcommittee.
Good afternoon, Co-Chair Witt, Co-Chair Frederick, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Tom Beiler. I'm the director at the Water Resources Department. On my left here is Kathy Connolly, our budget analyst with the Department of Administrative Services, who I'm sure you've seen on regular occasion over the recent weeks. I'm pleased to be here to give you the presentation on the department proposed budget for the 2017-2019 biennium. I'm going to step you through, so you'll be hearing from me primarily, and I'm going to be stepping you through the budget presentation organized around the chapters that you have in your budget binder. So we'll be talking first agency overview, performance summaries, going through our key performance measures. We'll look through our divisions and programs. We'll move to budget drivers, and then talk about the governor's budget and the legislative pieces that Matt was mentioning to you. And then lastly, we'll go through the reductions as part of this presentation. I want to say at the outset, though, that I've been at the department now for 2.5 years. I've been very grateful to be working with the fine staff at the department. They're hardworking, they're conscientious, and very resourceful in what they do. And I hope as you hear this presentation, you'll have a better appreciation for the work that they do and the challenges that we have as an agency. As I go through my presentation, I'm happy to take questions at any point along the way. I'm going to try to move us fairly briskly. We've got 2 days to go through this presentation. There may be times when I won't be able to answer a question, and I've got a great team behind me that I may call up with the permission of the co-chairs on occasion, and I'd like to just introduce them to you briefly before I get started. So this is the executive team for the agency, a fine group of people, very pleased to be working with them. And if they could just raise your hand as I identify you, Brenda Bateman, who is the administrator of our technical service division. Lisa Snyder, who is the administrator of our administrative services division. Ivan Gall, who is our field services division administrator. Dwight French, who's our water rights services division administrator. And Raquel Rancier, who you've probably seen a few times around this building, is our senior policy coordinator. And then last but not least, and I hope I'm not missing anybody, last but not least is our deputy, Doug Woodcock, who works very closely with me on the day-to-day operations and oversight of the agency.
Cool. Did I miss anybody?
Okay, good. Thank goodness. Okay. So let's get started. By way of orientation, I'm going to state what I think is the obvious, that water is perhaps the most critical resource on the planet. It is connected to virtually everything that you can imagine, everything that's around us. It is a vital resource for our communities to support drinking water supplies. It's a vital resource for our economy. If you think about industry and business, agriculture that relies on water, and it's a vital resource for the environment that we live in, fish, wildlife, and our ecosystems. That said, with that in mind, it's not without some irony for those of us at the Water Resources Department that deal with water supply and water quantity issues on a daily basis that for most people, they don't think about water much in their day-to-day lives unless there's not enough of it and we're in a drought, or there's too much of it and we're in flood situations. But that said, it's an incredibly important resource, and we want to step you through over the course of the next 2 days, kind of an understanding of how we at the state go about managing this important resource. So first of all, just to give you a sense of a lens that we look through, we are very mission-driven, and our mission is simply to serve the public by practicing and promoting responsible water management. Now, we have two co-equal goals that coincide with that mission, and that is, one, to restore and protect stream flows in order to ensure long-term sustainability of the ecosystems, economy, and quality of life in Oregon. And the other co-equal goal is to directly address Oregon's water supply needs. Now, the shorthand that I look at for those two co-equal goals is that we need to be looking at both out-of-stream and in-stream needs as we go about our business. Now, that's important for us to recognize, and I hope that as we walk you through description of the agency and our programs and what we do, that you'll see how our programs and responsibilities connect to that mission statement and those co-equal goals. And I think you'll hopefully also get a flavor for the challenges that we have in terms of carrying out our responsibilities. One thing to bear in mind that is really important in the world of water and water management is that these issues have a long history. And if you really think about the world that we work in terms of water management, it really started in the mid-19th century. As migrants came into the state and started to settle, they began to use the resource for a variety of different needs. They would, as an example here, you'll see on the left the Shirt Tail Gulch. I don't know how many of you have been to Shirt Tail Gulch, but it's in between Baker City and Ontario in case you're vacationing. That'd be it's a little dry over there, I'll tell you that.
Shirt Tail Gulch?
Yes. Gulch. And it's... it is this written document here is a claim to water. I think 500 inches used for mining in that area at that time from 1878. People were staking claims to water, essentially, during that time period. And it's an important thing to recognize because that became the basis for water use in Oregon and in the arid West. First in time, first in right is a credo around water use, and we are based on a very senior system. Those water rights, as they are quantified and become certified through various mechanisms that I'll talk about over the course of the next 2 days, they need to be honored over time. And so all of these decisions and actions that were put into place in some cases 150 years ago still are part of our management system today. And we don't start over every year. We start with the system of rights and uses that were made over many, many, many decades. Now, what's important about that is that our values change over time as well. But we are somewhat set in stone with those uses that were made based on the seniority system. The other piece of this I'd mention on these two other pictures, and I'm not going to go into the pictures on every slide, but in the bottom.
Senator Girard.
I have to ask. The claims for 500 inches. Now, usually they're in acre feet, at least today they are. What do they mean by 500 inches? 500 inches of what?
You know, that's, co-chairs, Senator Girard, excuse me, we've been debating that ourselves. That's not how we quantify things today, and we could follow up with you to give you a sense of that, but that's really not the measure that we use today.
500 inches of what?
Yeah. Okay. I assume that it was water and not dust, but in that area, it's debatable what might be able to get. I would mention, though, in the bottom right-hand corner, co-chairs and committee members, the 20th century was really, especially the first half of the 20th century in the early years up through the mid-century, was a lot of public investment in water delivery system infrastructure. The bottom right-hand corner are some of the early Bureau of Reclamation projects in the Klamath that really changed the area and allowed for a lot of development and agriculture in that area that otherwise would not have been available. And I don't know the origins of that top right-hand corner picture. I want to assure you, though, that's not the Water Master making the rounds in 1909. And if it were, I would tell you that we've updated our transportation quite significantly since then.
Looking for 4X.
So the Water Code was developed in 1909. This is the state statutes, and it recognized that water is a public resource, and it charged the state for having responsibility for managing the use of that public resource. When we talk about water rights, we're talking about authorizations and permission, essentially, to use a public resource based on certain terms. And as I mentioned in the last slide, it's based on a seniority system, and I want to just step you through just to give you a sense of how that works on the ground. If you can imagine in this picture, the blue squiggly line is a river. It's flowing towards us. And at the bottom of the picture, you see a senior water right holder, 1910 senior water right. And upstream from that senior is a 1970 junior water right. So in times of low flow, that senior water right holder may say, hey, I don't think I'm getting all the water I'm entitled to under my right. They'll talk to the water master, our staff, and say, I'm making a call. I want to make sure that there aren't any juniors upstream who are taking my water. When we get that call, we will take measurements of the stream. We'll see what's upstream in terms of the junior users and make a determination of whether that junior user should get shut off entirely in order for the senior user to be able to use their water. That's the basics of how it works. You can imagine how complicated it gets as we get more and more users on a system and being able to make sure that we're protecting those senior users. But that's a big part of what we do. This system is what everyone who gets a water right understands is the rules that we play by. And junior users, when you get a junior use, they know that they are susceptible to regulation in dry years, whereas the seniors certainly are in the catbird seat. So part of having that long history means there's changes over time, and I wanted to give you just a quick sense of the evolution of the state water law over the years. 1909 is when we started the code, and that basically laid out the ground rules for people who, from that point forward, wanted to apply for a water right. There was a system for us to go about that, and it also codified the system of management based on this prior appropriation seniority system that I mentioned. the 1909 code was primarily focused on surface water sources, and it wasn't until 1955 that the state recognized statewide groundwater as a public resource, and also created a similar framework around a seniority-based prior appropriation system for groundwater. It was around that time, by the way, in the mid-20th century, that due to surface water streams starting to become fully appropriated, folks were more interested in groundwater resources for more than just domestic uses, for irrigation, municipal uses, et cetera. And also around that time, the technology was such that well drilling became much more efficient and effective at being able to access groundwater in a more meaningful way. So the Groundwater Act was, I think, responded in part to those pressures and demands. It wasn't until 1987 that the state recognized in-stream water right or in-stream values as a beneficial use that can be protected by a water right. And the In-Stream Water Rights Act allows state agencies, the Department of Fish and Wildlife, Department of Environmental Quality, and the State Parks Department to apply for water rights to protect interests related to their mission. Those water rights, if approved, then become the responsibility of the Water Resources Department to protect over time. And we have a number of those around the state. But as you can imagine, given the fact that those weren't recognized until 1987, they are very far junior to many out-of-stream uses that predate that period. 1989, this is not a statutory piece, but I wanted to mention this because this is an important element around how Oregon approaches, how we're trying to approach management of water around the state. In 1989, we developed a water allocation policy related to surface water sources. And the whole notion around the water allocation policy is that we wanted to avoid over appropriation of the resource. We want to, if we're going to hand out water rights, we want to do two things. We want to protect the existing users on there so that we don't have too many users who might injure or at least create more possibility of injuring senior users. And secondly, we want to make sure that when we're issuing new water rights, that there's a reasonable predictability that water is going to be available to that water right holder, rather than just issuing water rights out without paying attention to the hydrograph. So we have now in place a system where we have done, through data-based system, we have been able to model and create water availability scenarios that help us make determinations on whether water is available for new water rights. I think that's been a very useful approach for us to avoid a serious over-appropriation in areas around the state.
Senator Jerrud.
Thank you. How do you determine, do you work with ODF&W to determine minimum stream flows for fish, or how do you do that?
Mr. Co-Chair, Senator Jerrud, certainly in terms of the flow needs for fish is really not our area of expertise, and we rely heavily on an agency like ODFW to be able to determine what the needs are for fish flows. And they're the ones that we would work with. For example, if new in-stream water right applications are filed, it would be ODFW who would be the applicant in that case. And our responsibilities would be just to determine whether water would be available or not for that purpose. So just getting to the end of this, in 2012, and I'll talk more about this later in the presentation, our commission adopted the Integrated Water Resources Strategy. This is an important document, and I will go into more detail later today and tomorrow. But the main point with the Integrated Water Resources Strategy is that it is a comprehensive strategic document that recognizes the interconnectedness of water. And while the real emphasis of the Integrated Water Resources Strategy is around the programs and responsibilities that the Water Resources Department has, it also accounts for the connections between what we do and water quality, the connections between what we do in energy issues, land use, fish and wildlife. So it's a very robust and comprehensive document that is helping to refine how we approach our business and guide our actions as we move forward. Last thing I'll mention just briefly is the Water Resources Development Program. Again, this is an item I'll talk about more later, but this is, it's important to recognize this one from my vantage point because many folks consider kind of the core activities, the core functions of what we do as an agency as connected to issuing water rights and water right-related transactions, and then managing the distribution of those water rights according to priority. And those are important. They're key components of what we do. What those functions don't do well, and what the Water Resources Development Program does do, is help communities gear towards their needs towards the future. The Water Resources Development Program is connected to those bond dollars that you were talking about earlier, those lottery bond funds. They help with planning, community-based collaborative planning. They help with technical studies associated with project ideas that communities and folks have in different parts of the state, and they help fund those water development projects. As Matt Stainer mentioned in his opening remarks, we have a public volunteer advisory or commission that advises us on and oversees the department in what we do. As you can see from the map, they represent different, or they come from different parts of the state under the statutes that authorize the commission. They are responsible for policy direction. They work closely with the department on that. They adopt final rules associated with the department. And they also are the decision makers on grants and loans associated with the water resources development programs that we have now. And I can tell you from my years in working with this agency and with OWEB prior to this, these are hugely important functions to have within the state governance. And I've really enjoyed working with these groups, and I've seen the benefits of having this type of check and balance with the agency, of having these oversight boards and commissions. So I mentioned our mission and the co-equal goals. Again, the mission is to serve the public by practicing and promoting responsible water management, both for in-stream and out-of-stream needs. The Integrated Water Resources Strategy has helped us refine that mission in some meaningful ways, and I just want to touch on these just briefly, because these are the underpinnings of how we're organized as an agency and how our programs are driven. The refinements are essentially that we need to understand the resource around the state to do our jobs well. We need to understand the needs that are emerging within communities, and then we need to understand the pressures that are affecting those communities. And that by doing that, we will be in a better position to meet both in-stream and out-of-stream needs. And so that involves, you know, collecting data, analyzing data, making that data available for our water users and for the public, both for water management purposes and for planning purposes. We need to understand the conditions on the ground and how they're changing over time. We need to, we have responsibility for protecting public safety around dam safety and well construction. I'll talk about that more later. We are responsible for the distribution of water rights. This is our water masters out in the field working with water user community and making sure that we have orderly use of water in accordance with prior appropriation. We provide technical assistance to communities and water users around the state. We also provide funding. This is the funding I was mentioning, these bond dollars, in terms of technical assistance, planning, and project funding. And then, of course, we process and adjudicate water rights. And I'll talk about all of these in much more detail as we get into, I think, Chapter 3. So we're going to pivot into Chapter 2. And this is the key performance measures. We have 14 key KPMs. As I walk through these, you'll note that we are meeting or exceeding on 10 of the 14. But before I walk you through these, I want to let you know that a number of these have been around for 17-plus years. Many of them were developed in the early 2000s. And we're interested in taking a look at assessing whether they need to be updated. So we're planning on going through a process, working with our stakeholders, working with our commission, working with our staff later this year, that will inform that analysis. As we go through these KPMs, I'd be very interested in any feedback that you have along the way, whether there's any KPM that you're particularly interested in us looking at. We would value that input. Our plan is to work over the next year on that, and that we would then have some potential modifications that we could bring forward probably in 2018 that then would be available for the legislature to consider probably as part of the 2019 legislative process. So I just wanted to give you that, and I'll talk about a few of these as we go through them, where we are anticipating, where we're either actively looking at them or we intend to look at them. So performance measure number one, this measures the percent of watersheds that had flows added where needed for fish. This is a, we're meeting the measure here, I think 24% is the target, and we're at 28%. We really rely on our partners to be able to be successful in this measure. Not only ODFW helping us understand where those key needs are, where the base watersheds are that need attention, but then we really rely to a great degree on landowners who are willing to cooperate and volunteer, for example, to perhaps lease their existing water rights to in-stream purposes. Maybe they are willing to permanently transfer water or go through some of our other programs that can allow for water to be moved from out-of-stream to in-stream purposes. Oftentimes, it involves also the good work of our other key partners, many of the conservation groups, watershed councils, and other organizations who act as the go-between between the department and the landowner to make those things happen. So we're really fortunate to have a very active community of interests who are focused on these types of issues and help us to be able to meet this goal. Second KPM measures the ratio of streams regulated to protect in-stream water rights to all streams regulated. The target here is 80%, and as you can see, we are hitting 95%. Key pieces to this measure are that we have the ability to be able to measure the stream and our ability to be able to have stream gauges out there that can provide good information, good data, and that we have staff who are available in the field to be able to follow through on understanding those measurements and then taking action as needed is important on this. I would mention this is one measure that we want to take a deeper look at. We want to take a fresher look at the methodology associated with this to make sure that we're getting this one right. So KPM 3, monitoring compliance. This measures the percent of total regulatory actions that found that water right holders were in compliance with their water rights and regulations. And in this particular measure, this is measuring instances where we take a regulatory action, and you know, there's air quotes around that because that is a term of art for us. It really relates to a wide range of activities that our field staff would take out in the field where we would intersect and connect to a water right holder. And what this is measuring is that when we take those actions, when we have those interactions with the water right holder, we are looking at a compliance check. Are they complying with the terms of their water right? And as you can see, based on those interactions, we get a high level of compliance, and we're, you know, I'm very thrilled with that from the standpoint that it really, to me, shows that there's a high level of education and understanding and awareness by the water right holder community. And it also says a lot about our field staff and their ability to be able to work successfully with the water right holders. I do want to mention this is a measure that can be easily confused, because what this does not measure is that 99%, and this is what it does not say, it does not say that 99% of all water right holders are in compliance with their water rights. This is a subset of water right holders that we're talking about, those that we connect with through those regulatory actions. So I just wanted to make that clear for folks. This is one, by the way, that we will be probably visiting this one as well. We have been working and started to work with our field division and our water masters and the regional offices, just taking a look at the workload associated with our field activities. It is significant. We're constantly being pulled in a million different directions. And so we're looking at taking the time to look at the workload and go through some debate internally about our priorities. And I think that could potentially inform this performance measure over time. KPM number four. On this performance measure and the next one, number five, I want to give credit to the legislature for giving us a huge assist. We are meeting and exceeding on both of these measures, and it's in large part because of funding that we've received from the legislature in recent years. In KPM 4, it measures the percent change from 2001 in the number of department-operated or assisted stream flow gauging stations. And I'll tell you that we will not be able to increase our ability on this area without funding for us to be able to purchase gauging stations and install them and maintain them over time. And in recent years, you'll see that how we're exceeding over the roughly 6 or 7% in recent years. In large part, that's due to new investment by the legislature to help us purchase and install more stream gauge stations. In 2001, we had about 215 of those stream gauges stations around the state, and we're now at 258. Similar tune here on groundwater. The KPM number five measures the percent changes in, from 2001 in the number of wells routinely monitored to assess groundwater. These, what we call observation wells, are really important for us to be able to understand over the long term what is happening with groundwater levels. This isn't measuring uses, nor was the previous performance measure. These are measuring broad, kind of more macro level. And in this case, groundwater and aquifer levels is a very important element for us to be able to, and tool for us to be able to manage and help protect groundwater resources for those users who depend on those resources. And in this case, also, thanks to the legislature, we've been able to invest in more observation wells around the state. In 2001, we had 350 that we were operating, and we now have 378 and counting as a result of the new investments. KPM number six, equipping citizens with information. This measures the percent of water management-related data sets available to the public on the internet. This is another measure that we want to take a fresh look at, largely because many of the items that these data sets that we had contemplated getting online and on available to the public, we've been successful in doing that. So we want to take a fresh look at this to see if there are some new items that we want to put in within this measure that could give us some new goals to go after. But here, really the underlying value is to make information available to the public, make it available to the water users, the consultants, other agencies who have an interest in what we do. KPM number seven, excuse me, I'm getting ahead of myself, is another information-related item. This measures the number of times water management-related data were accessed through the internet. I think of this as just, you know, how many hits are we getting on our website seeking discreetly seeking information. Our target is 2.25 million, and we are exceeding that. We're at 2.69. This is a good sign. You know, we definitely, given our staff resources and given this day and age, there's no reason we shouldn't be really trying to utilize the internet as much as possible to be able to communicate with the public effectively. We see this as a way to be able to measure how successful we are in that regard. KPM number eight. We are not meeting this KPM. This has to do with measuring the number of significant diversions with measurement devices installed, and it relates to in the year 2000, our commission developed a water use measurement strategy, and the goal was to move the agency forward in terms of working with existing water users to start getting more of those users to install measurement devices so that we would have a better handle on what was happening out in different parts of the state. We are, as you can see, we're not meeting the targets over time. We are making progress, but we're at nearly 1,000 measurement devices installed out of roughly 2,300 that are part of this goal. What's important to recognize here is that we're focusing on a relatively few number of water rights. We're trying to focus on the ones that have the biggest volume of use. So when you look at that range of uses in those systems that we're addressing with this KPM, it's about 10% of the diversions that we're focusing on, but it's about 50% of the water use. And so we're continuing to work on this one, but we have committed in working with our commission, again, to take a fresh look at this. We're started to have conversations with the water masters around the state, and we think that we'll have some modifications on this one coming forward as well. KPM number 9. This measures the percent of water management and conservation plans that have received a review by the department within 90 days of submittal. Water management and conservation plans are plans that are developed primarily by municipalities, community water suppliers. These provide, I think, very useful tool and exercise for those providers to go through. It helps them to be better managers of the resource, to understand how to be good managers. Helps them prepare for emergencies, which, as in the drought year in 2015, can be very useful to have a game plan in your back pocket. And also helps these community water suppliers start thinking about their future needs and developing long-term plans. In this case, we are we're exceeding our target, and I think it's in large part because of the good relations that we have with many of these municipalities who are responsible for submitting these plans. We've done a lot of outreach and education with them. The plans are getting better and better that are being turned in, and I think that's helping also for us in terms of our review to be able to be timely in those reviews. KPM number 10. This measures the percent of water right applications that received an initial review within 45 days of application filing. As you can see, there's a 55% goal. That's the target goal. And you can see that we are not doing well, nor have we done well on this over time. This is a statutory goal. It is within our water right permit application process. When an applicant submits a permit request, we have 45 days to do an initial review, and that gives the applicant a kind of a general sense of whether water is available, and you know, some signal about whether they have a good chance of moving forward with a continued review or not. If they decide to not go forward at that point, they can get a full refund of their application fees. Otherwise, if they move forward, then we would go through a more comprehensive review process. The issue here is primarily around how things are more difficult for us around groundwater applications. About 86% of the applications that we receive for new permits are for groundwater. That is a symptom of surface water during the times of year when people want it most. It's generally not available around most of the state, so people are going to groundwater. I mentioned that water availability review that we have done for surface water. We don't have that for groundwater, and groundwater is a complicated resource. So for every groundwater permit application that comes in the door, we have to have staff who focus specifically on that application to determine whether water is available. That's a technical review. It takes a lot of time, and our groundwater staff are getting pulled in many, many different directions, including focusing on basins who are dealing with groundwater declines. Measurement and taking measurements around the state on a regular basis is also an extremely important part of what they do. That's an area we certainly want to improve on. Without significant increase in staffing at this point, I don't see a way for us to really change our trajectory a whole lot, and I know that is a tough prospect. KPM number 11. This measures the percent of transfer final orders that are issued within 120 days of filing. And as you can see, our 30% target is being exceeded here. We have done a lot in recent years in terms of streamlining our processes, working with staff to get better at how we go about our process. We had a backlog of about 760 transfer applications in 2004. We've whittled that down to about roughly around 300 today. Our goal is to get to about 200, and if we're at 200, then we're basically keeping up with the demand that's coming in on a average basis. We've seen an influx of an increase in recently of about 33% of new above what we expected in terms of transfers coming in. So we'll always be dealing with that ebb and flow, but we're feeling pretty good about how we're working on this, and we want to be able to continue to meet this over time. KPM number 12 measures, this is designed to measure efficiency in field regulatory activities, and really what we're looking at here is how many points of diversion per FTE in the field. It's a pretty crude way for us to be able to try to measure how what our capacity is in the field to be able to cover our responsibilities. In this one, the target is the dotted line going across, which is, I think, 2,400 points of diversion, each of those taking water out of a stream per staff person. In this case, we want these bars to go below the target. We want fewer points of diversion per staff, which means we'll have more capacity to be able to attend to the business that we have. We're close, but we're not there at this point. This also will be a measure that we may have some recommendations on based on the review that we're doing in terms of our field workload. KPM number 13, this has to do with water use reporting. It measures the percent of water users that have annual water use reporting requirement and that have submitted reports to the department. In this case, these are public entities that are required by law to report. If they're a water right holder, they have to report on their water use annually. So it could be local government, state agencies, irrigation districts, et cetera. In this case, you'll see the big shift in terms of our productivity around this in the years 2014, 2015, and 2016. And I can tell you that it's a direct result of having staff available to be able to do this. We had a staff position restored, I believe, in the 2013 legislative session. And that makes all the difference in the world for us to be able to do the outreach and communication with these public entities to make sure that they're complying with this requirement. And lastly, this is the fourth item that we're not meeting our performance measure, and it measures customer service. And this is another one that we're going to be taking a look at. I think you've seen similar versions of this, but I will just step you through the customer service rating that we're looking at. On the far left is looking at overall, and it's looking at multiple years over time, starting from 2008 on the left and 2016 on the right. So we look at overall performance in terms of customer service. We look at accuracy, availability of information, expertise, helpfulness, and timeliness. And I can tell you that I'm not pleased with the numbers that we have here. And it's a bit of a head scratcher for me, quite frankly, because we're not doing anything different than we've done before. And it's troubling to me that our numbers have gone down from the previous year. We do know that there are a couple of things that we're looking at. One is the number of people who responded to the survey was down considerably for this reporting period. So we don't know if that skewed the numbers a little bit. But the whole issue has us wrestling a little bit with this measure. And for example, this measure looks at the people that we survey are folks who received final orders around our water rights related transactions. And they're definitely appropriate people for us to be looking at. But when I think about the range of activities and services that we provide for the public, it's much more than just that division. So I'd like to take a look, and we'll be talking with our stakeholders and perhaps you all down the line about maybe broadening this measure so that it has so it looks at a variety of different services that we provide, because that would be very useful for me to understand how we're doing in the different areas that we interact with the public.
Senator Jurette.
Yes, the question I have, and I probably should have asked this earlier, and maybe you hit it and I just missed it, but who actually sets the targets? Is that DAS or LFO? Or is that internal in the agency?
Mr. Co-Chair, Senator Girod, I believe it's the legislature that does that.
So
we'll be bringing recommendations to you all.
So it's LFO?
Chair Witt, Senator Girod, LFO does make recommendations, sets the targets, and we formulate those recommendations by having conversations with both the agency and with members of the subcommittee. And then when we go to do work session on any budget, but in particular this budget, we'll bring you a KPM, a proposed KPM for the next biennium, and it'll include all of the KPMs that LFO recommends to be continued, anything that needs to be deleted, anything that the agency's brought forward to replace or to add to their KPMs, or even if it's something from a member of the committee's asked to have something that particular project. And we'll bring those with goals, and we'll ask for your approval during the work session.
I'm just going to add a little bit. I'm not the person that likes a tremendous amount of oversight, and these KPMs cost every agency in order to try to comply with them an awful lot. Having said that, we need oversight, and it has to be appropriate. But sometimes when we're setting goals at 100% or 99%, that's, I don't know, I believe in Bell curves too, that gets expensive at the back end of it. So I guess that's my two bits.
Understood. Please.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. We're going to move into Chapter 3, and if I'm successful, maybe we can get through this chapter so that we would, right before the end of the hearing today. This has to do with the divisions and programs of the agency. Just want to step back for a second and remind you of our mission, which is to serve the public by practicing and promoting responsible water management, and again, the co-equal goals for both in-stream and out-of-stream purposes. I hope that you will, as we walk away from these discussions, feel that that our agency, as we're organized and our different programs, that we are oriented around trying to achieve that mission and work toward that mission. Again, really having a strong responsibility and need for good data, for responsible distribution of water, being able to make decisions around different water uses, providing technical assistance and funding and assistance for planning and projects. So I'm going to step you through first just by, and I'm not going to go through all of this in this, but just to give you a sense of how we're organized, we have, these are the key divisions, and within each of these divisions, field services, water rights services, technical services, our administrative services and director's office, there's different levels of expertise housed within those different units within the agency. What I want to emphasize with you today and tomorrow is how much we interact with each other and how much we depend on each other in what we do in carrying out our and trying to achieve our mission. Well, I'm going to start or go through today division by division, give you a sense of the responsibilities and the work that we have in those different divisions. First of all, I'm going to start with our Water Rights Services Division. And in this little this will walk you through kind of the how one gets a water right and what it means. When one applies for a water right, the date of their application is their priority date. That's a really important element of working in the water world. Your priority date is very meaningful. After the review, if a permit is issued, then that permit holder has a responsibility for what we call proving up on that right. So they have to develop the water use in accordance with the terms of the water right. And there's specific periods of time under the statutes for them to do that. They can receive extensions of time if they have good cause for needing more time. But the ultimate goal for the water right holder is to receive a certificate. The certificate is something that once you have your certificate, as long as you continue to use that water, don't stop using it, that you have it in perpetuity. You have it essentially forever. And you also, with the certificate, are able to make transfers and changes in the use, the place of use, the points of diversion, et cetera. So you have more flexibility with a certificated water right and more certainty of that use over time. So this division is involved with decisions around those water right related transactions. We receive, roughly, I think this last year we had about 416 new water right applications. Again, most of those are for groundwater, but it also can be for storage rights and other types of uses. Extensions are an area of continued workload for us. In terms of protests, this is also the division that involves working on folks who don't agree with our decisions around proposed orders associated with water rights. And we pride ourselves on successfully resolving many protests. But as you can imagine, those protests will come from maybe the applicant themselves if they get an answer they don't like, or it may come from a third party who may be concerned about the potential new use. In any case, we spend a considerable amount of time up front trying to resolve those issues before it goes to administrative hearing and where we accrue additional expenses through contested cases. We also have a certificates program, and the work involved in going from a permit to a certificate is significant to prove up. It's an important process to go through. That final certificate is a hugely important document to the water right holder. We have made significant progress in eliminating a backlog. In 2004, we had about 6,000 certificates or pending review for certification. We've now whittled that down to 1,200, so we're pretty excited about that, and it's a real testament to Dwight French's shop and the staff there to get through that process. And then transfers, of course, I've talked about that a little bit as part of the performance measure. The other items or other areas within the Water Rights Services Division involve adjudications. This is at the outset of this presentation, I mentioned that the state water code was adopted in 1909. I also mentioned that there are a number of uses that predate that in the 19th century. Those uses ultimately need to be certified and documented, and that is an adjudication process is what we use to do that. And most surface water areas around the state have been adjudicated for surface water, there are still much needs to be done around groundwater adjudications for those groundwater uses that predate the 1955 code. But it's an important process. It allows us to quantify rights that predate the code. It also allows us quantify what we call reserved rights for both federal agencies and tribal claims. And just to give you a sense of an area, we have had an active adjudication now in the Klamath Basin since 1975, and it's not done yet. But it has been it's high stakes for those water users and the community. The next item here is around stream flow restoration and conservation. We have a section within the Water Rights Division that works with the water user community and other interested stakeholders who are seeking to transfer water in stream through a variety of different tools. This group works on those issues and deals with temporary in-stream leases or permanent transfers or processes proposals for what we call allocations of conserved water, and that is where we have a very innovative program that allows efficiencies and conservation actions that result in water being saved. That water can then be used for both out-of-stream and in-stream purposes. This is the section that also deals with water management conservation plans, working with municipalities primarily in that arena. I talked about that earlier. And it is also, we have a staff who deal with hydroelectric issues. This is an area where the Water Resources Department works with a team of agencies. We are the lead. We also there are hydro staff associated with Department of Fish and Wildlife and Department of Environmental Quality. And we all work toward decisions around the reauthorization or relicensing of hydro projects. Or if a new project would come in, we would be responsible for consideration of water rights and licenses associated with that, or any modifications to existing hydro facilities. There are about 154 projects statewide that, that we oversee and we're responsible for. They pay annual fees that help cover the costs of our staff as well as the staff of the other agencies. I want to move next into our technical services division. This is the data division, and they definitely data and I guess public safety is how I would frame this this division. They are extremely important complement and ingredient to our overall efforts as an agency. First, I just want to mention briefly our information services section. They do a range of things for us. What we would call application development. I'm not talking about applications for water rights, but more along the app that you might have on your iPhone. They design useful mechanisms on the internet for folks to understand the information that we have. So they'll do map, make maps useful in terms of understanding water rights other ways of taking what can be very complex and dry data and make it meaningful to our stakeholders and the general public. They also manage the data and a myriad of different databases that we have housing important information. They provide technical support for our agency and our staff, and they are our point persons in terms of information technology security as we work with DAS and the state more generally on those issues. This is also the division where we have our surface water scientists, our hydrology section. They do hydrographics, which are essentially responsible for the kind of where strategically where we measure water and surface water. They are responsible for the purchase and selection of the gauging stations that we use and other technology that we use to measure water use and the resource more generally. This is also a section that deals with the surface water availability. I mentioned that at the beginning, towards the beginning of the how important it is for us to be able to protect existing users and to protect from over-appropriation. So that surface water availability analysis is very important for us, and having that function resides in this section. And then lastly, this group also helps us with water use reporting. As I mentioned, there's annual reports that we get from public entities, but we also have a number of water right holders who are required by condition to report on their uses. And lastly on this slide are groundwater science folks, and these folks have quite a task. I'll tell you, I've learned a lot about groundwater in my time here we see more demands on that resource. These folks are experts in terms of collecting and analyzing data associated with groundwater. They're the folks that we would have working on groundwater studies, as the study that we have in the Harney Basin right now that the legislature funded in 2016. They are folks who help us with permit review applications on the technical analysis associated with new permits that are for groundwater use, and they provide technical support in a myriad of ways for us around well construction, around regulatory and other matters that we deal with on a regular basis. The other important part rely on our technical services division to help us with is dam safety and well construction. These are both public safety areas. With dam safety, we are responsible for the inspection of about 900 dams statewide. These are dams that are 10 feet tall or higher, and that they have 3 million gallons of water, 9.2 acre feet behind them. So dams of that size or larger that are not otherwise under the purview of the federal government. So we aren't responsible for dam safety inspections on the federal dams in the Willamette Basin, for example. So that 900 dams, we are responsible for inspections. We have two staff who carry out this work. One of them a limited duration position that you'll hear more about because we're seeking to make that position permanent. The main focus, we probably get out, and the number that's in my head, and I hope it's correct, is about 230, I think, inspections in the recent year around the state. We have about 70 or so dams that are of particular interest to us because we classify those as high hazard, which means simply that they, if they were to fail, they would endanger human life. So we pay particularly close attention to those. Fortunately, most of those are in good shape. There are a handful of those that are not in the shape that we would like them to be, and we are working closely with those dam owners to make the necessary adjustments. Secondly on this is well construction. And with this...
Co-Chair Frederick.
Yes, I'd love to have a map of where those dams are that you're concerned about. Is that possible?
Mr. Co-Chair, the high-hazard dams? Certainly. We certainly can get the ones that I think there's maybe five that are high-hazard and are not in the level of maintenance and repair that we would like. Those will be easy for us to get. The 70, we'll do what we can, but we can certainly turn around that first one very quickly for you.
That would be very helpful. Thank you.
Thank you. In terms of well construction, integrity of wells as they're constructed is extremely important. If they're not constructed appropriately, it can cause depletion of aquifers, it can affect the pressure in those systems, and it can create contamination issues. And that is not only a problem for that particular well owner, but it could be a big problem for those other wells that are sharing that same system. So this particular section is responsible for the well standards, the standards that we require for appropriate well construction. We work closely with the well driller community and landowners who are interested in drilling their own wells. We do continuing education and a lot of outreach with those well drillers to make sure that they understand the standards. We work with folks quite closely to make sure that they are doing their best to construct these wells appropriately. This section also deals with enforcement, so compliance in cases where folks are not adhering to those standards, we have the ability to follow up with them. I'm going to move next to our field services division. This is the fabled Water Master Corps, but it's more than that. But these are folks that cover a lot of ground, both literally and figuratively, in terms of their responsibilities. Extremely important. These folks are housed throughout the state, work in the community, live in the communities that they work, and they have to really know a little bit about almost everything. They have to understand the range of policy issues that we deal with and are responsible for. They are responsible for managing and distributing water, which really is as much art as it is science, from the standpoint that it's the successful work is done by getting to know the people that you're working with, establishing relationships, establishing strong communication, so that folks understand where they're at in terms of the priority system, and that they understand generally what it means when there's a shortage of water and how that will affect them. Our folks do a great job in the field in terms of those relationships, and it really helps us to have pretty smooth regulatory systems during drought years. Even folks understand where they sit in the pecking order, and the compliance is very strong generally. These folks also help us in terms of doing a lot of the measurements that help inform the data that our technical services division is responsible for. Because these folks are out in the field, because many of the areas that we need to measure, both from surface water and groundwater standpoint, are out in their areas, we rely on them heavily to provide those measurements and then feed that back to our technical, our science staff, both from a surface water and groundwater standpoint. They also help with dam inspections, not so much on those high-hazard dams, but on the ones that we try to periodically go through and make sure that we're covering some of those other dams that are have less risk associated with them. But we want to make sure that we're checking in on those as well, and our field staff can help with that as well. Then, of course, just general community outreach and education. The Water Master Office and our regional offices are the places where people come if they have questions. And we spend a lot of time working with the landowners and water users in that regard. This, I just wanted to give you a sense of how we're organized in the field. And this may be a little bit difficult to follow, and I apologize for this, but we have five regions that we're organized around. We have a northwest region you'll see in the top left, southwest in the bottom left. Then moving over from there to the right, you'll see the south central region. Then further to the right, further east, the east region. And then above that, along the Columbia Basin, is the north central region. We have regional offices in each of those areas, Salem, Medford, Bend, Pendleton, and Baker City. And then we have 21 water master offices, and that's these individual numbers that you see with the different colors associated with them are the areas where we have water masters who are responsible for the day-to-day management and regulation of water as it's in over the course of the year. And just to give you a sense of the scale and scope of what some of our staff are responsible for, we have a water master in Burns. And that's a big area. And as you can imagine, if our water master has to travel to the south end of that district, essentially the border with Nevada, that can take all day just to do that one trip.
Mr. Chair. Representative Esquivel.
Do we have anyone in Klamath Falls? Why wouldn't the person leave from Klamath Falls instead of Burns?
Depending on where you are.
Well, we have... Mr. Co-Chair, Representative Esquivel, Burns is the area that we have on this, as you can see on the map here. That's the area that we have responsibility for. We do have our folks in the Klamath Falls area are, as you'll hear from me later in the presentation, very busy dealing with issues of water management in the Klamath Falls area, as well as we have a water master in Lakeview. So to the extent that we can move folks around, we do. We do have water masters that will help each other out on occasion. But these are the geographic areas that we've designed for our water masters.
Hello.
Please.
You say you have one in Lakeview. Well, Lakeview is even closer to Klamath Falls than Klamath Falls is to southeast Oregon by the border. Why wouldn't you dispatch out of Lakeview instead of Burns? I'm not following the logic here.
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Esquivel, I appreciate that comment. And as I mentioned earlier, we are talking with our field staff and our field services division about looking at our workload. And I think that the question that you're asking is a fair one, and it's probably part of what we'll be looking at in terms of not only what do we do, but how do we organize ourselves around that. So I think from my vantage point, it's an open question for us whether some redesign of our districts would be appropriate to help us be more effective. So I appreciate that comment. All right. The director's office. This is the office that deals with intergovernmental relations. We oversee the policy direction of the agency, work directly with our commission in that regard. We have responsibility for overall operations of the agency on a day-to-day basis. We work directly with the governor's office. We are the general interface with the legislature, as well as with our federal delegation and federal agencies. We are, I have the communications in here, which I have to comment with some is bittersweet for me because we don't have any communication staff. We don't have any staff who are formally dedicated to that. We certainly have the need to communicate, and that was made clear to me in 2015 with the drought conditions that we had. And just to give you an example of how we approach things when we have a severe and significant situation like the drought of 2015, that created a huge need for strong communication with water users around the state. And we did not have a communications shop, and so we essentially reassigned a number of staff toward that end over a prolonged period of time for us to be able to maintain that level of communication that was useful. So that's an ongoing need for us in the office, but it's also an ongoing responsibility. We are, the director's office also is responsible for those KPMs that I mentioned and making sure that we're meeting milestones that we have, that we're performing adequately across the agency. And lastly, this Water Resources Development Program, this is the bond program that helps with collaborative planning at the local level and technical grants and project grants. That's currently housed primarily in the director's office, just so that we can keep track of it. It's a new program, doesn't have a division or section of its own at this point. And also the Administrative Services Division. This is a key entity for us in our organization. These folks help us with our grant and loan administration. They are the ones who will make sure that we're following through on receipts that we receive on grants, make sure that we're making payments in a timely manner. They also are experts on loan issues. They do contracting for us. The fiscal services in terms of payroll and benefits, they are our resources around that. They also provide our human resources services for the agency. And our business services, which I kind of look at as our kind of our macro issues around budget development and tracking our budget at a higher level. So with that, Mr. Co-Chair, I've covered the first three chapters. We've got 5 minutes. I'd be happy to start diving into the budget drivers piece if you're interested at this point.
This is probably a good place to break and see first if there are any questions or comments from the subcommittee members.
Thank you.
I'm not seeing any, so I think this is a good place to break.
Very good.
Thank you very much for your presentation today. With that, I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 5542. Anything for the good of the order? Not seeing anything. We thereby stand adjourned. Thank you all very, very much. Thank you for your stand adjourned. Thank you all very, very much.